Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man Number 4, Savage Territory. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Thomas Penny, Scott McCormick, Eric Messner, David Coyne, Thomas Keegan, Joe Brack, Kimberly Gilbert, Nanette Savard, Michael John Casey, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Mort Shelby, Christopher Sheeran, Johan Detweiler, Drew Kopis, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Andy Clemens, and James Lewis.
It was hot and dry at Fort Bowie in the Arizona Territory, where elements of the 8th Cavalry were conducting their daily exercises. New recruits under the watchful eye of sergeants were at drill, both mounted and dismounted. Older hands were conducting work details from mucking out stables to rubbing down horses to making needed repairs on the various buildings of the post. One hapless soldier wearing a sign that said, "I was insubordinate," was walking around the perimeter of the post in uniform, carrying a fully loaded pack and rifle. He would be performing this punishment detail from sunup to sundown, the entire day, taking only a short 5-minute break every 2 hours. The U.S. Cavalry, operating under a set of tactics known as Upton's Tactics, was organized as 10 regiments of 3 battalions each, with 4 companies to a battalion. Each company had 1 captain, 1 first lieutenant, 1 second lieutenant, and 77 enlisted men. The mounted trooper carried a light cavalry saber suspended from a waist belt. A pistol was carried on the right side, handle facing forward, in a large flapped holster. He also carried a single-shot breech-loading .45 caliber carbine, which hung from a carbine sling that was tucked into a leather socket affixed to the McClellan saddle just behind the trooper's thigh. Elements of the 8th Cavalry, under the overall command of General Crook, were stationed at Fort Bowie and were engaged, and had been engaged for some time now, in pursuit of a militant band of Apache Indians led by Geronimo. The bugle call for officers' call was sounded, and the officers of A Company, 1st Battalion of the 8th, assembled in the headquarters building in response. Matt Jensen was one of those who responded to the bugle call. Although Matt was not an Army officer, nor even in the Army, he was currently employed as a scout for the Army, and as such held the equivalent rank of a first lieutenant. He stood now at the window of the headquarters building, looking out over the quadrangle as he waited for the meeting to begin. Being a cavalry scout in pursuit of Apache Indians was not his permanent occupation. It was just an occupation that had temporarily caught his interest. Matt was a wanderer, always looking for what was beyond the next line of hills or just over the horizon. When he was on the trail, he traveled light with a bowie knife, a .44 double-action Colt, a Winchester .44-40 rifle, a rain slicker, an overcoat, 2 blankets, and a spare shirt, socks, trousers, and underwear. Escaping from an orphanage when he was 12, he was found more dead than alive by a man named Smoke Jensen. He learned everything he knew from Smoke, who took him in and raised him until Matt was old enough to go out on his own. It was then that Matt dropped the name Cavanaugh, which was the last name of his biological father, and took the name Jensen. Matt turned around as Colonel McKenzie, the post commander, came into the headquarters.
Captain Trevithan has gone over his plans with me, and I have given my approval. I leave you now to discuss your scout. Captain, the floor is yours.
Thank you, sir! Gentlemen, I call your attention to the Dragoon Mountains.
Trevithan pointed out the mountain range on a map that was pinned to the wall.
If every man in this company will follow my plan to the exact detail, I am confident that we will rid this country of the savage Geronimo once and forever. Our Indian scouts tell us he has made his camp here.
Trevithan pointed to a spot on the map.
Lieutenant Bristol, you will take your platoon out on scout to locate him. I will establish the rest of the company here. As soon as you locate him, send a heliograph signal informing us of the same. Once we receive your signal, we will launch the attack, smashing Geronimo once and for all.
Excuse me, sir. You're going to detach an entire platoon for a scout?
I am indeed.
Wouldn't it be better if I just took a scout and a couple of signalmen with me?
I want the scout to be in strength, Lieutenant. That way, if Geronimo attempts to escape, you can be in position to block him.
Yes, sir.
I am going to be counting on you, Lieutenant. In order for this plan to work, I must be able to depend on you following my orders to the exact detail. You do understand the importance of that, do you not?
Yes, sir, I understand.
Good. I'm glad that we understand each other. Now, gentlemen, I know that Geronimo has eluded the army for so many years that many of our troopers, I fear, have bought into the idea that he possesses mythical powers. But after this operation, that myth will be dispelled once and for all. If you follow my plan of operation to the exact detail, we will cut Geronimo to pieces, and the Eastern Press will no longer make a hero of him.
Captain, with all due respect, sir, you have not encountered Geronimo before. You may find this operation more difficult than you realize.
Yes. Well, I realize this will be my first scout since arriving out west. But I have taught military tactics at West Point for the last 4 years. So it isn't exactly as if I'm a novice in the art of warfare, now is it? Our civilian scout has not commented. Mr. Jensen, what say you?
I'm not that impressed with your plan.
Oh, really? And pray tell, Mr. Jensen, if it isn't too much trouble, what is wrong with my plan?
I'll be happy to tell you what's wrong. You've drawn this plan up as if you're engaging an organized army on a battlefield. You aren't attacking an army, Captain. You're attacking smoke. You have tactics you can use against smoke?
Your description is quite colorful, Jensen, but you are making my point. When you compare Geronimo to smoke, you are just perpetuating the myth. I will make allowances for your inability to understand the basic concept of this operation, Mr. Jensen, because you are just a civilian. And I cannot expect you to grasp the intricacies of military tactics. But this mission is one of classic cavalry deployment. And if we stick to our carefully prepared plan, as I fully expect us to do, the Indians will not escape.
Captain, I've been out here for a couple years now, and I know the way these Apache devils operate. And I must confess that I believe there is something to what Mr. Jensen is saying.
Lieutenant, if I may ask, how did you get your commission?
I got a direct commission from the ranks, sir.
A direct commission from the ranks?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant, I am not only a graduate of the military academy, but as you well know, I taught military tactics there. Do you really intend to challenge me?
No, sir. I would never do that.
I would hope not! Now, gentlemen, by this time tomorrow, we will have a victory to celebrate. Return to your men and prepare them for a midnight departure. I expect us to be in position, ready to strike, at dawn's first light.
By dawn the next day, in accordance with Trevithan's operational plan, the company, minus Bristol's platoon, had reached their debarkation point. Then, from a distant hill, there came a series of mirror flashes from the heliograph Bristol had carried with him.
By Godfrey, we've got him! Men, Lieutenant Bristol has spotted the Indians! Get mounted! We are about to carry the fight to the enemy!
Sergeant Emerson mounted first, then started up the dry creek bed.
Sergeant Emerson, where do you think you are going?
I'm going to take the point, sir.
I want no one at point to give away our position.
Begging your pardon, sir, but in terrain like this, you have to have someone riding point.
Sergeant, you are forgetting your place! One more word from you and I will charge you with insubordination. Now return to the company at once.
Yes, sir.
Captain, if we're going to be riding up the creek bed without a point, then we should at least have flanker riders on either side.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen, but you were hired as a scout, not as a tactician. Please refrain from any further suggestions along those lines. Flanker riders will slow us down.
It's your command.
Yes, Mr. Jensen, in that you are correct. Forward ho!
Half an hour later, the dry creek bed narrowed precipitously, and Matt felt the hair on the back of his neck stand up.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking, Mr. Jensen?
You mean, do I think it looks like we're riding into a trap? Yes.
Maybe the captain ain't noticed it.
Captain Trevithan, have you noticed how them walls is closing in on us? This ain't good, Captain. This ain't good at all.
Well, thank you for your concern, Sergeant Emerson. If it's all right with you, we will continue according to the operational plan.
Captain, you are aware of what happened to Custer, aren't you?
That will be enough from you, Mr. Jensen. As soon as we return from this scout, I intend to see Colonel McKenzie and have your service with the U.S. Army terminated.
That won't be necessary. As soon as we get back, assuming we do get back, I intend to resign from the scout service.
Please do. I think that would be best for you and the Army.
To Matt's relief, they were not attacked while they were in the narrow ravine, but they made contact with Bristol without ever encountering the Apache.
Where are they? Your signal said you had spotted them, and they were coming toward us up Bitterwater Creek.
They were between us, sir. I don't know what happened to them.
Are you sure you spotted them?
Yes, sir. We all saw them.
Well, they couldn't have just disappeared like
smoke, Captain.
That's enough, Lieutenant! You are bordering on insubordination.
Yes, sir.
Now, I want you to...
Indians!
A veritable cloud of arrows rained down on them. Obviously, a coordinated attack.
Dismount! Dismount! Form a skirmish line!
Trevithan, no! We can't dismount here. We have to get to more open ground.
God damn it, Jensen! I'm in command here! I said dismount!
Captain, Mr. Jensen is right. We can't...
Oh, we must retreat!
No, we need to attack!
Then retreat, God damn it!
As the men watched in shock and alarm the panicked action of their commander, Trevithan was hit in the back by an arrow. Fell from his saddle, but his foot hung up in the stirrup, and the panic-stricken horse galloped at full speed up the creek bed, dragging Trevithan behind him. Trevithan's head slammed against a big rock, opening up a huge gaping hole that left a trail of blood.
Bristol, Manning, we need to attack now! Column of twos, forward!
The cavalrymen felt a renewed sense of confidence in their leadership as they galloped out of the kill zone.
Lieutenant Bristol!
Yes, sir!
The Indians are on both sides of us! You go left, I'll go right!
Yes, sir!
The galloping troopers split into two different directions. Very quickly, they came upon the Indians. The troopers had the advantage of superior numbers and mobility, and their surprise counterattack routed the Indians. Some were able to mount and ride away, but most of the others were on foot, and they ran from the attacking troopers, disappearing into the gullies and crevices that traversed the area.
Somebody halt!
By now, nearly all the Indians had managed to escape. Then, Matt saw one of them at some distance. The Indian was sitting on his horse, staring back at the cavalrymen without the slightest indication of fear.
Trooper Jones, you know a lot of the Indians who left the reservation. Is that Geronimo?
No, sir. That particular Indian goes by the name of Del Shea.
Del Shea?
Yes, sir. He ain't nearly as old as Geronimo, but he's damn near smart.
For a long moment, Matt and Del Shea continued to stare at each other. Finally, Del Shea turned and rode away, his leisurely movement giving evidence of his disdain for the Army troops who had been in pursuit.
Lieutenant Bristol?
Yes, sir.
It is your command, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Bristol, now being the senior officer present, took command, and the company, with 12 killed, including Captain Trevithan and Sergeant Emerson, returned to Fort Bowie. 9 of the returning cavalrymen were wounded, a couple of the wounds severe enough that the soldiers had constructed travois to bring the men back. The bodies of the dead were brought back, draped over their horses. 6 horses had been so badly wounded that they had to be destroyed, and that required doubling up some of the bodies on the remaining horses. Colonel McKenzie met the dispirited company as they rode through the gate.
Where is Captain Trevithan?
Belly down on one of the horses.
Lieutenant Bristol!
Yes, sir?
I want you, Manning, Jensen, and the senior NCOs at headquarters as soon as you dismiss the men.
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Bristol gave the report, mercifully not condemning Trevithan for his mistakes.
Mr. Jensen, you are the senior scout. It was your responsibility to keep Trevithan from riding into an ambush.
I beg your pardon, sir, but if it hadn't been for Mr. Jensen, our losses would have been much higher.
Matt Jensen tendered his resignation that very day. 2 days later, he was on a train heading back up to Colorado. His experiment as an Army scout concluded. To many, the metal bit jangling against the horse's teeth, the hooves clattering on the hard rock, and the creaking leather saddle might be little more than a cacophony of disparate sounds. But to Matt Jensen, it was music, a symphony that defined the life he had chosen to live. In the 6 months since Matt had resigned his position as scout for General Crook, he had earned his keep in a variety of ways, from riding shotgun for Wells Fargo to transporting a prisoner for the sheriff of Fremont County to delivering a string of horses from Higbee, Colorado to Belmead, Kansas. He was just returning to Colorado from the horse wrangling job now. Matt wandered from occupation to occupation because he wanted to, not because he had to. In truth, Matt had a rather tidy sum of money earning interest in a bank in Denver, the result of a very successful operation in which he and his friend and mentor, Smoke Jensen, had panned for gold. Smoke now owned a very productive ranch, and if Matt wanted to, he could probably own one as well. But Matt didn't want to. He enjoyed the idea of being as free as tumbleweed, feeling at home anywhere he happened to be, but putting roots down nowhere. Dismounting, Matt unhooked his canteen and took a swallow, then poured some water into his hat. He held it in front of his horse, and the horse drank thirstily, though Matt knew that the small amount of water would do little to slake the animal's thirst. Spear drank all the water, then began nuzzling Matt for more.
Sorry, boy. That's the best I can do for now. We'll reach Crocker's ranch before nightfall, and there'll be water there for both of us.
Before Ian Crocker got married and settled down, he and Matt had wintered together in the mountains. But Crocker married a schoolteacher and started a ranch. It wasn't a large ranch, but it was successful enough that he was able to make a living at it. Now, Matt planned his trip so as to stop and call on his old friend from time to time. Unbeknownst to Matt, even as he was approaching the ranch, there were four unwelcome visitors. The four were Bert Philbin, Dearmont Cantrell, Abe Oliver, and Percy Morris. They had tried to hold up a bank in Bent Canyon, Colorado, only to run into a time lock safe that prevented them from getting any money. Leaving the bank empty-handed, they barely escaped with their lives and were forced to ride out of town under a hail of gunfire from the armed and angry population of the small town. The four outlaws had happened across the ranch by accident earlier that same afternoon. There, Crocker's generosity provided water for parched throats and the promise of food for starving bellies.
Where is Meacham?
Cantrell looked at the others. Leaving the four would-be bank robbers to drink thirstily from his well, Crocker had gone back inside the house to tell his wife that they had unexpected company. Because of that, he was out of earshot, and the men could speak freely.
He was supposed to meet us at the bank.
Well, maybe he found out that the bank had a safe with a time lock, and he knew we wouldn't be able to get any money.
If I found out he knew about that but didn't tell us, I'll shoot him.
Yeah, right, Bert.
What? You don't think I won't?
Billy Meacham is your cousin. I don't see you shooting your own cousin.
Yeah, well, maybe not. But I don't know why the son of a bitch didn't tell us about the time lock on that bank vault.
Could be worse.
Now, how could it be worse, Abe?
We wasn't none of us killed when we rode out of town. Not that they wasn't trying hard enough. Swear, it seemed to me like everyone in them town had a gun and was shooting at us. Shit, women and kids, too.
Got that right.
Matt reached Crocker's ranch at about the time the sun was a large orange orb sitting low in the western sky. Matt saw four saddled horses tethered out front. He walked over to look at them. It was obvious they'd been ridden hard recently, and they had not been rubbed down, for streaks of salt stained their coats. There was something sticking out from under one of the saddles, and as Matt examined it more closely, he saw that it was a sackcloth with two eye holes. It was a mask. The front door to the house opened, and Crocker stepped out onto the porch.
What are you doing there, mister?
I'm getting water for my horse.
Water your animal and get. We don't like strangers around here.
All right. I'm obliged for the water from my horse.
After Spirit drank his fill, Matt remounted, then rode away. Matt waited until after dark before he returned. Leaving his horse hobbled behind a stand of aspens, he slipped up to the side of the house. From inside, a flickering light managed to escape. Also, it wasn't totally dark outside because it was a cloudless night and the moon was full and bright, so that the house and barn seemed in a soft, silver light, like white blooms in a meadow. With his gun in hand, and staying in the shadows alongside the wall, Matt found a window and looked inside. There, he saw four men with Crocker and his wife. One of the men was pointing a gun at Crocker. Because he'd been on the trail, Matt was unaware of the fact that these four men had attempted a bank robbery earlier in the day. But he had known right away that they were the cause of Crocker's strange response when he had arrived earlier in the evening. Katie Crocker was holding, clutched tightly to her chest, a silver candelabrum.
Please, we have given you water, food, and shelter, but you cannot take this. This candelabrum was made by my great-grandfather. He was apprenticed to Paul Revere.
Well, who's Paul Revere? It don't matter who Paul Revere was. This here is silver, and I intend to have it.
No, you can't have it.
Woman, you better think about what you're doing here. You are either going to give it to me, and I'm going to kill your man and you and take it. I'm going to have it either way. If you don't give it to me, you'll both be dead.
Matt ran around to the back door and, finding it unlocked, pushed it open.
Drop the gun!
What the hell?
The man was standing by the one flickering candle, and he snuffed it out. The inside of the house was immediately plunged into darkness. Matt felt a hammer blow as a bullet slammed into his shoulder. Matt raised his pistol. Matt couldn't see who went down. A moment later, he heard the front door crash open, and he hurried through the house and out the back door to try and stop them. But they had already mounted and were galloping away. By the time Matt got back inside, Crocker had relit the candle, and he and Katie were looking down at the man Matt had shot.
Oh, damn, my belly hurts.
Who are you?
Are you the one that shot me?
Yeah, I'm the one that shot you.
I'm dying, ain't I?
More than likely.
Yeah, I thought so.
Who are you?
My name is Marsh. Percy Marsh.
Who are the others?
Don't know their first names. I only hooked up with them a couple of days ago. We robbed a bank in Bent Canyon. So if you was looking for us, you found us.
The only thing I was looking for was water. I didn't know you robbed a bank.
Truth is, we didn't. I mean, don't get me wrong, we tried to rob it. It just didn't go all that well.
Who were the men with you?
I wasn't sure you were going to come back after the way I acted when you were here first.
Ian, didn't you think I knew why you were acting like that?
Well, I figured you would. I know that I sure hoped so.
Oh, you are bleeding.
Yes.
Where's your horse?
He's outside, tethered behind the stand of cottonwood trees.
I'll go bring him in while Katie cleans and bandages your wound. Then we'll fix you some supper and feed Spirit.
Thank you. Spirit thanks you as well.
Almost 800 miles south of Crocker's ranch, a band of Chiricahua Apache warriors, the same band Matt had scouted against, were still eluding General Crook's army. The leader of this particular band, Del Shea, whose name meant walking bear, dismounted and held up his hand. This was a signal to the other warriors who were with him that they should stay down in the ravine. Del Shea crawled up the hill, then lay down and looked just over the crest. 2 weeks earlier, Del Shea had led this same group of warriors in a bold attack on an army supply wagon. The attack had been successful, and without losing even one man in the raid, Del Shea and his men had killed the six soldiers who were guarding the wagon. In addition to defeating the soldiers, Del Shea's little band of Apache Indians had come away from the skirmish with a veritable treasure of powder and ball, as well as bacon, beans, and flour. Del Shea took his prize back to the main Apache camp, and that night the Indians had danced and sung songs in his honor. But some had complained that Del Shea's raid had just increased the danger because, as a result of that operation, the army, under General Crook, had sent a fresh platoon after them. Del Shea made a solemn promise that he would find and kill all the soldiers who came after them. Now, from his position at the top of the hill, Del Shea could see the 30 soldiers who had been tracking him for the last 2 days. Evidently, the soldiers were planning to make camp here, for already they had unsaddled their mounts constructed a hasty enclosure for them, and stacked their carbines. The soldiers, who had no concept of light or sound discipline, had lit a couple of campfires, and they were blazing brightly as the soldiers busied themselves in the preparation of their supper. Turning toward the warriors who were with him, Del Shea signaled for them to come up the hill. One by one, the seven men of Del Shea's small war party moved up the side of the hill, then got down on their stomachs and eased up to look over the crest. Del Shea raised his rifle. He saw dust rise from the tunic of the man he shot, and he saw the man's eyes open wide in shock before it fell. Del Shea's opening shot was a signal to the others. The firefight was brutal, fast, and one-sided. In less than 2 minutes, all the soldiers of the little detail either were dead or had run away. The Apache warriors swarmed down the hill, going to the bodies of all the soldiers to make sure they were dead. Then they went through the packs of the slain soldiers, taking whatever they found, including several bottles of whiskey. One week later, Del Shea was back in Goyathle's mobile camp. Goyathle was the head of the small band of warriors to which Del Shea belonged. For over 10 years, Goyathle, better known as Geronimo, had raided Mexican and American settlements at will, easily avoiding the vast army that had been sent after him. And while Del Shea had not been with him for all that time, he'd quickly become one of Geronimo's most effective warriors and leaders. The smoke of a half dozen campfires lifted into the sky, perfuming the air with the aroma of cooking meat as Del Shea walked out to the edge of the mesa. He stood there for a long moment, looking north. Goyathle came up to stand beside him.
You wish to go back to your woman?
Yes, Goyathle.
I think you should return.
I cannot return.
Why not?
Because the return would be to abandon you and my brothers. That I will not do.
While you were with us, you fought well. You will not leave us. You can never leave us. For no matter where you are, your warrior spirit will remain with us to fight with us against the whites.
That is not enough. My warrior spirit cannot shoot a rifle. My warrior spirit cannot shoot a bow. Only my body can kill our enemies.
And only your body can look after your woman and your children. Go now. Be with them. It is the thing you must do.
I have learned much from you, Goyathle.
Do not let the lessons you have learned here die with you. Our children and our children's children, as well as the children of their children, must forever keep alive the spirit of the Chiricahua. I have had dreams, Del Shea, and I have read the signs. I know that the time will come when there will be no Chiricahua. Then the memories we pass on to our children will be all that is left of our people.
This I will do. You have my promise.
My brother, the dreams and the signs I have seen are also about you. They tell me that there will be much sadness in the life that awaits you. But there will also be much honor. For you will become a leader whose name will be spoken with wonder for many seasons to come. Even after you have died.
God this day, Goyathle. Goodbye.
Egogahan Del Shea. Until we meet again.
New York City. Ken Hendel, a rather small, fastidious man, cleaned his wire-rimmed glasses, then carefully put them back on before stepping up to the window. He was in the third story of a brownstone mansion, and as he stood at the window, he looked down on Union Square and the statue of a mounted George Washington.
Mr. Hendel?
Turning away from the window, Hendel saw Dr. Petrie standing just outside the door to Mr. Montgomery's bedroom.
Is he still alive?
Yes, for now. He has asked for you.
Hendel nodded, then stepped into the room. Because the drapes were closed, the room was dark. And even though it was quite large, it seemed close. It was also redolent of the smell of scented candles put into the room in an ineffective attempt to overcome the stench of putrefying flesh.
Ken! Ken, is that you?
Yes, Mr. Montgomery.
Come closer, Ken. Sit by me for a while.
Kendall moved a chair closer to the bed and looked at the man for whom he had worked for the last 8 years after having assumed the same position his father had held for the previous 30 years. Joel Montgomery, a shipping magnate, was a wealthy man. But now the 76-year-old man was dying of cancer. It was warm in the room, and there were beads of perspiration on the old man's forehead. Handel took a washcloth from a basin on the bedside table and bathed Montgomery's forehead.
You are a very good man, Ken.
You have been very good to me, Mr. Montgomery, and to my father before me.
It is no wonder that you are a good man, for your father was as well. You come of good stock. I made a mistake, Ken.
I beg your pardon, sir?
I made a mistake. I should have never insisted that Cynthia marry Bixby. He's not the man I thought him to be.
Handel did not respond to the comment. He had felt that way about J. Peerless Bixby from the moment the old man pushed his beautiful young daughter into marrying him.
You don't like Bixby, do you?
Not particularly.
You were against this marriage from the beginning, weren't you?
I wasn't sure it was the best thing for Miss Montgomery.
Oh, for heaven's sake, man. Why didn't you say something? Why didn't you speak out?
I am but an employee, sir. It was not my place to speak out.
Nonsense, my boy. You are much more than an employee. I did not want to presume. Yes, well, it is all water under the bridge now. I don't mind dying, Ken. Death comes to us all. But it does gall me to think that I have compromised my daughter's future. I thought that by having her marry Bixby, I was providing her with a husband who is a good businessman and who would look after her for the rest of her life. I fear now that all I have done is make it so that she will be beholden to him for the rest of her life.
That is not necessarily the case, sir.
What do you mean?
There is a way to ensure your daughter's security. That is, if you are willing to take those steps.
Yes!
Papa?
Take care of that for me, Ken, will you? Whatever you have to do, do it.
I shall require your signature, sir.
Then, by all means, do it quickly, while I still have the strength to hold a pen.
Papa!
Cynthia! Yes, dear, come in. Come in.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to intrude. I'll return when your business is done.
It's done. Ken was just leaving.
Miss Montgomery, I beg your pardon. I mean, Mrs. Bixby.
Mr. Handel, you have known me as Cynthia Montgomery for my entire life. It isn't surprising that you would slip up.
I suppose that's right. I'll get right on that, Mr. Montgomery.
Good. Good. I appreciate it.
Papa, you are looking better this morning.
Oh, nonsense, my dear. I am dying, and I am closer to death this morning than I was yesterday.
Well, Papa, if you put it that way, we all are.
I suppose we are at that. Thank you for coming by to see me, my dear. Have a seat, and tell your papa all that you've been doing.
Handel left before the conversation went any further, but he was happy to hear that the old man was still able to laugh. When Handel stepped into the parlor, he saw J. Peerless Bixby sitting on the sofa, looking at photographs through a stereopticon.
Mr. Bixby, my business with Mr. Montgomery has concluded. If you wish to go in now, you may.
Cynthia's here. She's his daughter.
Oh, but I'm sure Mr. Montgomery would enjoy a visit from you as well.
I'm not going in there. It stinks in there. It smells like the old man has already died.
I agree. It can get a little close in there.
Where are you going when the old man dies?
I beg your pardon?
When the old man dies, you'll be out of a job, won't you?
Yes, I suppose I will.
So where are you going?
I don't know. I haven't actually given it that much thought.
How would you like to come work for me?
You are offering me a job.
Yes.
I'm surprised.
Why are you surprised?
Because, to tell you the truth, Mr. Bixby, I've always had the belief that you didn't particularly like me.
I don't like you. You're just too damn meek for my taste. I like a man who has a little gumption.
And yet, you offer me a job.
What does one have to do with the other? I'm wanting to hire you, not socialize with you. Besides, a little obsequiousness is not a bad thing for an employee. I don't want to be challenged.
I see.
And let's face it, I'll be taking over the old man's business. Who knows his business better than you? I think it's a very good situation for both of us.
What does Mrs. Bixby think?
Doesn't matter what she thinks. I'm the one hiring you, not her. But, as a matter of fact, hiring you was her idea. Normally, I wouldn't listen to any suggestion she had to make, but in this case, I think it was a good one. So what do you say, Handel? Do you want to come to work for me?
Mr. Handel! Mr. Handel, please come quickly. Papa is calling for you.
Handel hurried into the room and saw Montgomery sitting up in his bed.
Mr. Montgomery, you should lie back down, sir.
The papers you want signed. Give them to me now, quickly.
But they aren't made out yet.
It doesn't matter. I'll sign at the bottom. You can fill them out later. Quickly, man!
Yes, sir.
Hurrying over to the old man's desk, Handel rifled through it until he found three blank sheets of paper. He brought the papers and a fountain pen to Montgomery. Montgomery signed all three of them and handed them to his daughter.
Witness that you saw me sign these.
What are they, Papa?
Do you trust Mr. Handel?
Yes, implicitly.
Then sign them.
Cynthia signed all three blank sheets of paper, then returned the pages to Handel.
I signed them, Papa, though I don't know what... Papa?
Montgomery was lying back on his pillow, his eyes open, and already clouding over with the opaqueness of death.
Papa!
Handel hurried over to the desk and picked up the telephone.
Number 271, please. Dr. Petrie, you had better return to the Montgomery home. I believe he has died.
Hanging up the phone, Handel walked back into the parlor. Bixby was still there, but now he was reading the newspaper.
Mrs. Bixby needs you, sir.
What for?
I'm afraid Mr. Montgomery has just died.
So? What does she need me for? If the old man is dead, there's nothing I can do about it.
Bixby went back to reading the newspaper.
Says here there's a beef shortage. The price of cattle is going to go sky high.
Joel Montgomery left instructions that he was to be buried at sea. He wanted his funeral to be conducted at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, a small neighborhood church that had come into existence primarily because of Montgomery's generosity. He had paid for the building and put enough money into the church coffers to hire a priest and organist. He had also been senior warden for the church, a position he held until the time of his death. The church was filled to overflowing during the funeral, and it wasn't until then that everyone realized just how generous a man Montgomery had been in his life. He had donated money not only to the church, but to several orphanages and needy families around town, and though during his lifetime he had kept his charitable contribution secret, his benevolence was well known to Ken Handel, who, as his business manager, had set up many of the altruistic endeavors.
My God, would you look at all of this?
Bixby was reading the pew sheet that told about Montgomery's beneficence.
With all the money he was giving away, it's a wonder he had any left at all. Well, I can tell you right now, that's all coming to an end. Handel, the first thing I want you to do is contact all these people and tell them the cow is dried up.
After the service in the church, Montgomery's body was taken by hearse down to the waterfront, where it was put on board the Prometheus, Montgomery's personal yacht, for transport to a spot far enough offshore for his body to be committed to the deep. Only his family and his closest friends were invited for that part of the rite, so Handel stood by as the body was taken on board.
Please, Mr. Handel, you must come.
There isn't room for me.
Take my place.
Oh, Mr. Bixby, I wouldn't want to put you out.
You won't be putting me out. I'm not going. Whether you go or not, I don't like boats.
Please do come, Mr. Handel.
Very well. I would consider it an honor.
Handel found a place at the bow of the yacht so as to be out of the way of the family. Then, when they reached the place where Montgomery was to be committed, he stood reverently while the priest intoned the interment prayer. As the body slid off the plank and into the water, he saw Cynthia making a strong effort to control her grief. He knew at that moment that he could not totally abandon her to J. Peerless Bixby. He would take the job Bixby offered. Besides, in his job, he would be better positioned to make certain that the papers he had filed after Montgomery's signature were followed to the letter. All conversations in the Hungry Miner Saloon in Fort Collins, Colorado, went silent. When the other patrons of the saloon turned toward the sound, they saw an angry Pogue Willis glaring at Juanita Simpson, one of the bar girls.
When you bring me a drink, don't you be a sticking your finger down into the whiskey.
Mr. Willis, I didn't have my finger down in your whiskey. Please don't hit me again.
Then don't be a lying to me.
Mr. Willis, I don't think you ought to be hitting a woman like that. Even if she did stick her finger down into your drink. It's such a pretty little finger anyway. Why, more than likely, all she done was sweeten up the drink a bit.
What's your name, mister?
It's Marcus. Lee Marcus. No need for you to introduce yourself, Mr. Willis. Why, I reckon everybody in town knows you. If not everybody in the whole state.
Marcus wasn't exaggerating. Pogue Willis had the reputation of being a gunman. It was a well-earned reputation, for Willis had put several men in their graves, at least 15, and maybe as many as 25, depending on who was doing the telling.
What was it you was just saying to me?
Nothing much. I was just commenting there didn't seem to be no need for you to go knocking around that young woman like you was doing. Even if she did stick her finger down into your drink, you know it wasn't something she'd done on purpose. And her being a woman and all, why, there's just no call for you to be beating up on her like that. I mean, when you think about it, it don't seem all that gentlemanly a thing to do, does it?
I'll tell you what, Mr. Marcus. Maybe you'd like to take a part in this fight. Because if you want to, I'll be more than willing to accommodate you.
What? A fight? No. What are you talking about? There ain't no fight here for me to take part in. I was just commenting as to how it don't seem right to me for a man to be hitting a woman, that's all. I sure wasn't challenging you to a fight or nothing like that.
Well, friend Marcus, it's too late. You done took a part in this fight. So, what are you gonna do next?
I ain't doing nothing next. I aim to let this drop, right here and right now.
It ain't going to drop. You started it, and I'm gonna finish it.
I didn't start nothing. You're crazy, mister, and you're letting this thing just get way out of hand. I done told you, there ain't no fight going on here between you and me.
Pogue Willis was not a very big man. In fact, he was only about 5 feet 6 inches tall, and he weighed no more than 145 pounds. His hair was a dirty blonde, and the skin on his face had a blotch of red, whether from a birthmark or a burn scar, nobody knew. In a normal world, Pogue Willis would live his life as unobtrusively as possible. But this was not a normal world. This was a world where a man like Pogue Willis, who should be a little more than dust under a better man's boot, possessed two traits that lifted him from the obscure to the feared. He was fast and accurate with a pistol, but more significantly, he had no more compunction about killing a human being than the average person did about stepping on a cockroach.
You know what I think, Mr. Marcus? I think maybe me and you ought to get this here little difference of opinion settled between us. Otherwise, a thing like this, unresolved, so to speak, is just gonna start a festering in my craw. And I don't like it when things get to festering in my craw.
Now, just hold on here, Mr. Willis. Wait a minute, please. I think you would agree with me that it is pretty obvious that me and you have got ourselves off on the wrong foot here. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy you a drink. Yes, sir, that's the best thing I can do. I really didn't mean to say nothing to put you to anger like I done. So why don't me and you just have us a drink that I'm offering and then we can just start all over. Bartender, how about you pour Mr. Willis another drink on me?
The man nodded and poured the drink, pushing it toward Willis. With a demonic smile still on his lips, Willis picked up the drink, held it up as if in toast, and suddenly, and without warning, tossed the contents of the glass into Marcus's face. Marcus just reached down and pulled a towel from one of the towel rings on the bar and wiped his face.
Well, I guess I deserve that for butting in where it was none of my concern. Yes, sir, I gotta hand it to you. You got me good with that little drink trick. So, with all things being considered, I reckon that makes me and you just about even now.
We ain't even.
Oh, sure we are.
Are you calling me a liar, Mr. Marcus?
Whoa, what? No, no, why would I call you a liar?
Here's the thing, Mr. Marcus. Me and you ain't going to be even till one of us is dead. And truth to tell, I got me this feeling that it ain't going to be me the one that winds up dead.
Whoa, wait a minute now. Hold on here. This has gone far enough. Let's quit this foolishness now.
Foolishness? Are you calling me a fool, Marcus?
You are right, mister. One of us is gonna die.
That's right. And it ain't gonna be me.
You dried up little son of a bitch. I'll be waiting for you at the gates of hell.
Marcus broke leather before Willis even started his draw. And for a brief moment, he felt a sense of elation. The sense that he might actually win this fight. But his hope was misplaced. Willis' gun appeared in his hand as if by magic.
Tell old Lucifer I'll be seeing him soon, but not today.
Matt Jensen, fully recovered now from the gunshot wound he had received at the Crocker Ranch 2 months earlier, was riding into town when he heard the sound of a gunshot. The single shot came from the other end of the street, and it put him on instant alert. Because Matt had lived an active and adventurous life, there were those who would like nothing better than to put a bullet in his head. He had managed to avoid that so far, not only by his own skill with pistols, rifles, and even knives, but also because of an acute power of awareness, the sixth sense that served men like Matt. He realized quickly that whatever the shot was, it wasn't meant for him. Relaxing from a momentary tenseness, he continued riding down the street at a leisurely pace. Matt had come to Fort Collins in response to a letter he had received a few days ago from a friend.
Dear Matt Jensen, I take pen in hand to write you to tell you of the success I've had in this here mine that you sold me. When you sold me this silver mine 2 years ago, you said it would pay off if and someone was willing to work hard at it. They was them who told me I was a fool to trust anyone who was selling a mine. There was something about you to give me trust. I am happy to say that you was right. This here mine ain't made me rich or nothing like that, but I have worked it regular since I bought it, and it has paid out a lot more than I put into it. So I thank you for it. On Wednesday, the 15th instant, I intend to be in Fort Collins cashing out my diggings from the winter previous. If you would care to meet me at the Hungry Miner Saloon, I'd be that proud to buy you a drink, then afterwards maybe you would let me buy you dinner at the finest cafe in town. Your friend, Lee Marcus.
Matt had been in Trinidad, Colorado, where the letter caught up with them toward the end of last week. And because he had nothing else planned, he decided he would drop in to see Marcus. A colorful profusion of late spring wildflowers, along with agreeable weather, had made the ride up from Trinidad quite pleasant. When Matt dismounted in front of the Hungry Miner, he saw several people hurrying into the saloon. He surmised from the flurry of activity that the shots he had heard had come from the saloon. And for some reason that he could not explain, he suddenly had the feeling that somehow his friend might be involved. Matt tied off his horse, Spirit, then joined the throngs moving in through the batwing doors.
You all seen it! Is there anyone in here who didn't see him draw again me first?
Looking over toward the bar, Matt saw Lee Marcus sitting on the floor, leaning back against the bar. The front of his shirt was covered with blood, and though Marcus was still alive, Matt had watched enough men die to know that Marcus had but a moment or two of life left.
Lee!
Matt hurried over to him, then knelt beside his friend.
Hello, Matt. Too bad you wasn't here a few minutes earlier. You missed all the excitement.
What happened?
Me and this little fella here got into a bit of an argument.
You do this?
Yeah, I did it. You planning on doing something about it?
Matt Jensen? This is Pogue Willis.
You're Matt Jensen?
Quickly, Willis put his pistol back in its holster.
It was a fair fight, Jensen. It was a fair fight. He drew first. You can ask anyone in here. Your friend drew first.
Is that true, Lee?
Oh, yeah. I just got tired of listening to the fella go on, so...
See, I told you. Look there. He said it his own self. He drew first.
Shut up, Willis.
What? Now, see here, you can't talk to me like that. I don't care who you are.
Willis staggered back against the bar and his hand moved toward the pistol.
do it. Please pull your gun.
Without saying another word, Willis stopped his hand just above his pistol, then moved instead to grab one of the bar towels.
I wasn't going for my gun. I was reaching for a towel.
Matt, lean down here and listen to me. Don't pay no attention to that punk. I got something else I want you to do for me, if you will.
With another menacing and warning glance toward Willis, Matt knelt beside his friend.
Matt, I got me a little over $2,000 in my pocket here. It's money from the diggings. Take some of it and buy yourself a train ticket to St. Louis. When you get there, look up my brother, Andrew. You'll find him listed in the city directory. I want you to give him what money is left. Will you do that for me?
Yes, I'll be glad to do that for you, Lee.
I got me a pocket on the inside of this vest. You reach in there and get the money.
As Matt was reaching for the money, the sheriff arrived and, seeing Matt, he pulled his gun.
Hold on there, mister. I'm gonna stand here and watch you steal from a dying man.
No, he ain't stealing it, Sheriff Allen. This here's my friend Matt Jensen. I'm giving it to him.
Matt Jensen? Yes, sir, I know who you are. You can go ahead.
I'll get it to him, Lee. I promise. I'll get the money to your brother.
Marcus couldn't answer from where he'd gone. Matt continued to stare down at his friend for a long moment. Then he turned his gaze toward Poe Willis.
No! I ain't get no...
That was as far as Willis got, because Matt grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and the seat of his pants, picked him up and sent him belly down, sliding for the entire length of the bar.
Sheriff, you seen it. I wasn't doing nothing but minding my own business when he grabbed me and tossed me like that.
Willis, did you kill Lee Marcus?
He drew on me first. Everybody in here will tell you that. That's why Jensen had no call to throw me down the bar like he done.
Well, I agree with you, Willis, but that seems like an awfully unfriendly thing for Matt Jensen to do.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you want to throw down on him, why, I reckon I won't try to stop you.
What?
Well, go ahead. Draw if you want to. I'll stay out of it.
No! Wait! That ain't what I had in mind. That ain't what I had in mind at all.
No, didn't think it would be. I tell you what, Willis, why don't you just give your gun to me now and I'll take you into custody until after the trial.
Trial? What trial?
Why, the murder trial, Mr. Willis. We're going to be trying you for the killing of Mr. Marcus.
But he drew first. Everyone in here will tell you he drew first.
Well, then the trial shouldn't be a problem.
Willis glared at the sheriff. It was obvious that he was considering this further, perhaps as far as drawing against the sheriff. But it was equally obvious that he was worried about the presence of Matt Jensen. The glare changed to a forced smile and, slowly, using only his thumb and forefinger, he pulled his pistol from the holder.
All right, Sheriff, let's have the trial.
Judge Heckemeyer arrived in Fort Collins in a black Surrey with yellow wheels. The Surrey was drawn by two black horses, each of which had a yellow tassel on its head. He drove straight through town to the Hungry Miner Saloon. The irony was that Poe Willis would be tried in the same saloon in which he had killed Lee Marcus.
Hello, Judge. Welcome to Fort Collins.
Hello, Seth. Let's get this started, shall we?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Anthony Heckemeyer presiding.
One table had been set up at the end of the saloon that was closest to the piano. Two other tables were set up, one for the defense and one for the prosecution. All the other tables had been moved to one side of the room, and 12 chairs had been set up for the jury. The remaining chairs had been put in rows for the spectators. There were only two lawyers in Fort Collins, and they took turns being the prosecutor. Today, the prosecution was being handled by George Dempster, and the defense by David Craig. Dempster called witnesses who testified that Pogue Willis had goaded Marcus into finally drawing his gun. Juanita Simpson was called to the stand. One of her eyes was black and nearly swollen shut. There was also a bruise on her cheek, both being visual evidence of the treatment she had received from Pogue Willis.
Now, Mrs. Simpson, would you tell us, please, in your own words, what happened?
Mr. Willis asked me to bring him a drink, and when I did, he accused me of sticking my finger into it.
Did you stick your finger into the drink?
No, sir, I did not. And I told him I didn't, but that didn't make no never mind. He hit me anyway. Then Mr. Marcus said to Mr. Willis that he didn't have no call to hit me like that. One thing led to another, and the next thing you know, there was shooting, and poor Mr. Marcus was dead. The thing is, Mr. Marcus died because he was taken up for me.
Craig began his cross-examination.
Miss Simpson, you say you did not stick your finger in Mr. Willis's drink.
No, sir, I did not.
Why do you think he accused you of doing that?
I don't know.
Oh, surely you know, Miss Simpson. Why did he accuse you of sticking your finger in the drink? Do you think it might be because you refused to do business with him?
Do business with him?
Yes, do business. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, Miss Simpson. What sort of business are you in?
I work at the Hungry Miner.
Is it true, Miss Simpson, that you are a whore at the Hungry Miner? And is it not also true that you angered Pogue Willis, not by sticking your finger in his drink, but by refusing to go upstairs with him?
Objection! Irrelevant!
Withdrawn the question. Miss Simpson, did you actually see the gunfight?
Yes, I saw it.
Who drew first?
You don't understand. Pogue Willis just kept on goading Mr. Marcus. He just wouldn't leave him alone. He was wanting Mr. Marcus to draw his gun.
Thank you, Miss Simpson. I have no further question for this witness, Your Honor.
When all the witnesses had testified, Judge Heckemeyer invited the counselors to give their closing arguments. Counselor for the defense was first.
Gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the witness to this shooting, and since it happened right here in the saloon during a busy time, more than a dozen were able to testify. More than a dozen witnesses had a good enough view of the shooting to be able to give us a very detailed description of what happened. And gentlemen of the jury, no one, not one witness, testified that Willis drew first. In fact, every witness has testified before this August court, an honorable judge, testified that it was Marcus who drew first. You may not like Pogue Willis. Indeed, few do, for he is not a very likable man. But you cannot find him guilty of being unlikable. And if you are honest with yourself, you know that you cannot find him guilty of murder either.
Dempster stood up when Craig sat down.
An unlikable man. Unlikable. He's not merely unlikable. He is an evil spawn of Satan. This unlikable man has killed 15 human beings. Do you fully understand that? 15 men. Men who were someone's son, brother, husband, and father. 15 men were killed by Pogue Willis. And now we are asked to find him innocent because the other man drew first? You have heard witness after witness testify that Pogue Willis goaded, cajoled, beleaguered, and intimidated Mr. Marcus until he felt that he had no other choice but to draw. It has also been testified here that Pogue Willis had a smile on his face as he pulled the trigger. I ask that you find this man guilty and that the judge sentence him to hang.
The jury adjourned to the back room of the saloon to make their decision. After only a few minutes of deliberation, the jury returned.
Mr. Foreman, has the jury reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Please hand the verdict to the bailiff.
The foreman gave a little piece of paper to the bailiff, who took it over to the judge. Heckemeyer read the verdict silently.
Mr. Willis, approach the bench. Pogue Willis, it has been testified to in this court that when a good Samaritan saw you hitting a woman, he asked you politely to quit. It has further been testified that you took issue with that good Samaritan and for no good reason began goading him, challenging him, and pushing him beyond reasonable limits until he was forced to draw against you. If it were my case to decide, I would find your sorry carcass guilty and sentence you to hang within the week. But it is a law of our land that you are to be tried by your peers. And your peers, following the letter, if not the intent of the law, have ruled that because Lee Marcus drew first, you are not guilty.
I knowed I was going to beat this one.
I am going to acquiesce to the ruling of the jury, for I have no other choice. However, sir, I am now issuing this court order. You are to vacate the town of Fort Collins and the state of Colorado. If you return to Colorado, I will have you arrested and thrown into prison for violation of this court order. I do not think, Mr. Willis, that you would fare very well in prison.
Judge! You got no right to run me out of the state!
You are free to appeal my decision, Mr. Willis. But in order to make that appeal, you will have to remain in the state. And if you remain in the state, I will put you in prison, where you will remain until that appeal is acted upon. So your choice is simple. Leave the state or make an appeal from behind prison walls. Now, which will it be?
I'll leave the state, Judge.
I thought you might see it my way. Sheriff, escort this man to the depot and put him on the next train.